Thank you, everybody. Jim, I don't know if I'm supposed to drink out of your water bottle, too. Is this like old school football? I didn't know what we're doing. Yeah, just do that. Yeah, don't touch it. All right, so I appreciate it, everybody. I, too, am going to take an hour talk and give it to you here in about 25 minutes. If you were here last year, if you've been to one of my talks before, you've seen part of this. Because what I've done is I just keep updating the talks with the new information, new data, sliding things in to kind of keep this a living document. If you happen to be from Louisiana, you may see it next week when we're down there for your Louisiana ASEP chapter meeting. So we're going to give us a little bit of a talk on opioids during the pandemic. No real conflicts here. I'm on the ASEP board of directors as well as medical director for some EMS stuff. So if you see me in the back with the NASCAR race on, it's because I'm the medical director for NASCAR and they're racing in California right now. So just got to know if I'm going to get some calls about meetings coming up. I thought this was a really nice, this conch shell, the spiraling opioid epidemic in America. Kind of where we started, the numbers really started getting, were first being watched in about 1999. We know that Purdue Pharma put out OxyContin in 1996. And since then, we've continued to have the elevated numbers. Interesting thing, we were making progress. We were actually starting to see some progress right before COVID-19. We saw things planing out of the deaths, even some trending down, especially in the Appalachian region, where we had so much difficulty throughout the years with the COVID pandemic. From 1999 to 2018, we lost 750,000 Americans from a drug overdose, around 68% of the 70,000 drug overdoses in 2017 involved in opioids. So if you ever want to calculate, because the way CDC reports overdoses, they report all overdoses, and pretty consistently between about 65 and 70% of those deaths associated will have some contribution from an opioid. So that's something to keep in mind as we move forward. So our deaths started to go down. They started to stabilize, even drop slightly. A prediction that they would stabilize and start to fall by 2022. But then, of course, just like everybody else, we had everything turned upside down with the COVID-19. I think it's obvious we played an unfortunate role in the opioid epidemic. The time we decided to let our guard down, the reason physicians really have angst and a skeptical view of pharmaceuticals. When you let that guard down, things like you get convinced that a five-sentence editorial means that a drug is non-addictive and has led to one of the largest, actually hands down, the largest epidemic in United States history with regard to drugs. So, but there's a lot of things that went into that. The combination of the pain is the fifth vital sign, the only subjective ones. Looking at Jayco, looking at Press Ganey, looking at the biases associated with those that were those suffering from an opioid use disorder or any type of use disorder. But just remember to keep in mind, and one thing that I always like to tell people is that the people that are suffering from an opioid use disorder or whatever use disorder it is, they did not grow up saying, I want to be a slave to a substance. They wanted to be firemen, police officers, doctors, lawyers, nurses, whatever it was. They had dreams like every one of us. And then they got off the rails at some point. And there's a lot of interesting data and findings as to why that takes place. But we had this perfect storm of all of these things that came together to not only kick off the opioid epidemic, but then to propagate it even further. And some of those things have continued as well. And, of course, our role is with this. With emergency physicians, we had this variation of prescribing of 7.3 to 24.1% of cases of people who came in were discharged with an opioid. Interestingly, there was no difference in their return, perception of pain, or whatever it was. The only difference, the higher prescribers tended to have higher long-term users or dependence on opioids and more returns to the hospital for reevaluation secondary to their pain symptoms, whatever it may be. So there really wasn't a significant change, but the long-term use risk between the lowest prescribers and the highest prescribers with a number needed to harm of 48. So it didn't take much for us to really start to put somebody in a bad place. But it's a simple reality that just having the substance does not mean you have addiction. There has to be susceptibility. And there's some neat research that just came out, the end of 21, beginning of 22, those risk factors. We'll talk about that here in a minute. But you have to have the substance and you have to have the susceptibility. But do we have a good way to determine that susceptibility when somebody comes in front of us in the emergency department? We have an average of 15 to 20 minutes of total engagement time with our patients during their entire course of care. Do we have the tools? Do we have the things? Do we actually have something that actually quantifies somebody's risk for dependence and addiction? It isn't always one of the, we're on a guy's trip out here. It's our first time since COVID this week, and I'm the only physician in the group. A lot of coal lawyers, farmers, things like that. So I'm like, coming out of a pandemic, I'm kind of like the oddity. Let's ask Ryan, these types of things. And so we were talking about these types of things, and come to find out, with this susceptibility, a lot of that susceptibility is not something current. It may be childhood related, childhood trauma, childhood abuse. A lot of those things significantly increase that risk. When was the first use of something such as tobacco or alcohol? Those things really make a contributor into that susceptibility. Because many people can take opioids after procedure without a challenge whatsoever. The two times I've ever taken it for surgery didn't touch me a bit. I didn't know anything about it. I just got rid of it. My wife recently had surgery, took two of them for their shoulder surgery, and then moved on and was fine with everything else. But you never know. We're going to skip that one because I just want to. But this is my kind of approach. We've had this war on drugs since I was young, since Nancy Reagan really kicked off that war on drugs. But really what it needed to be a war on addiction. The world is ready and prepared to provide us all the drugs we could ever need. An endless supply. In fact, we'll talk about that here in a minute on where we are. But if we don't treat the addiction, all we're going to do is change the substance. We're just going to move people to something else. So we have to focus squarely on the addiction and help them get through this. Methamphetamine use increases in Northern Kentucky as authorities focus on opioids. Because we focused on the opioids and not on the addiction in trying to maintain and bridge that reward pathway. And now what we're seeing, we'll talk about the changes in methamphetamine, which is the only thing that has gone down in price the last couple of years. This is actually a new book out, Sam Quinones. You can hear it on the ASAP Frontline podcast. Interviewed him a few weeks ago. It's a follow-up of the Dreamland book. That's the one that really started off all my talks. This is a follow-up of where we are now, telling the stories of some of those in addiction. I'd strongly encourage you to read it because it really does put a human touch on when, where, and why, and how this is all interconnected. Wonderful person, and I like it because he's not medical. He is he's an investigative reporter, so I get to see it from that angle. But the point he made in his research is this evolution. For the first time in U.S. history, the majority of drugs that aren't called marijuana that are on the streets of the United States are synthetic. You used to have a field and growing conditions and farmers and harvesting. With ephedrine version of methamphetamine and heroin, that all required manual labor and farms and things until we transitioned to ephedrine, went to P2P meth. P2P meth is actually a type of methamphetamine that has actually been known for almost 100 years now, but actually came back. It's made purely from a synthetic fold. In fact, I saw a something this morning that one was seized with $20-something million worth of methamphetamine. But interestingly, since COVID, the cost of methamphetamines has dropped 80% because we're flooding the market with synthetic meth. They can make it an astronomical. The problem with P2P meth, much faster deterioration to psychosis, homelessness, and much longer recovery period. Recovery periods taking 9 months, 12 months, or more in an inpatient setting before people start to become themselves again. Heroin. We didn't think you'd ever need anything cheaper than heroin, but with the morphine equivalents that were necessary, we saw that transition to fentanyl, again, another completely synthetic opioid. And then what the challenge there is with the concentration of fentanyl, it's very difficult to mix it. And if you have a pharmaceutical company, you have these very intricate methods of tumbling and mixing those. What they're using is the magic bullet, which is used to make smoothies. Unfortunately, that doesn't actually mix fentanyl very well. And so you'll have one person who gets a dose that is just some cut and has no fentanyl whatsoever, then you'll get one dose that is all fentanyl and that person overdoses and dies. So we're seeing this transition to P2P meth and fentanyl meth. And what I said a few years ago, first time I was at this conference, is that recovery starts when people hit rock bottom. Unfortunately, they don't make rock bottom now. They die. Because of the concentration of the medications and drugs that we have out there now. And of course, COVID came along, which upended everything that we do. It decreased access to recovery, to resources, to counseling, to appointments. It did exactly what breeds addiction continuation, which is isolation. We made people sit at home or sit wherever they live, not being able to engage with others, not being able to go to their appointments, not being able to get their treatments that they need. And I know we're trying to watch out for the COVID pandemic, but at the same time, we've got hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in need of recovery resources. A ton of fear. I mean, COVID was one of the first time I heard physicians saying, I'm a little bit afraid. And I was too. We walked into our first case. Your first case was the one you discussed. Mine was a stroke that came into the CT scanner. Everything classic stroke, come to find out it was COVID. I still have a picture of going into the first room dressed up like I was going into Chernobyl. And now we're just all gallivanting in there like nothing's going on. Depression and behavioral health complications is definitely part of this second pandemic. While ER visits were down last year, drug overdoses increased amid the pandemic. So our ER visits were down, but our behavioral health and opioid use disorders and alcohol use disorders visits continued to increase in the emergency department. So trends in U.S. emergency department visits for mental health, overdose, and violence outcomes before and during the COVID-19 pandemic. So significant, statistically significant changes because everybody went through a lot. Loss of jobs, loss of income, loss of connection, loss of friends and family. It's just been 2 years of loss. And that's why I think we're happy to see some of these changes, and hopefully we can start to put this back on the shelf as something that we can try to get back to normal, whatever that may be. Humans are a creature that require and thrive on community and being together with each other. And so the first conference that we had that was in person, which actually this one was the first one last year, but then having ASAP 21 in Boston and actually seeing all these people that I had only seen in two dimensions for 2 years, that was pretty impressive and fun. From December 30th, 2018 to October 10th, 2020, total ED visit volume decreased. Everybody knows about that. We all strained through all of that type of stuff. But we saw these significant numbers. This is just showing that significant increase in opioid use disorders and overdoses. So our visits were down, but opioid-related complications were up significantly. All right, so here's this right here is that trend I was talking about. We were starting on our way down, right? And then COVID hit. And now we've skyrocketed once again. A lot of states out here in the West were continuing to go up anyway. They hadn't reached the peak, and we're not going over the edge. But around the eastern United States, especially the southeast, Appalachian region, we were already over that hump and starting on our way down. And we were celebrating that. We were so excited about that. We were on the back end of the opioid epidemic. And then COVID comes and just wrecks everything. In 2020, 93,000 overdose deaths. Again, take 68% of that is going to be how much the opioids contribute. 37 of 38 jurisdictions, available synthetic opioid data reported increases in synthetic opioid-involved overdose deaths. During the time that I've been an emergency physician, we've gone from the primary opioid cause of death from methadone to methadone, heroin, and now fentanyl. Got to get them in the right order. 18 reported increase by greater than 50%. 10 Western states reported over a 98% increase in opioid-related deaths or deaths in general. So what does have to happen? First and foremost, we've got, as healthcare, we have to get the addiction facts, the truths, the realities. These are human beings. One of my favorite groups of people to talk to in the emergency department, other than World War II veterans, which is becoming more and more rare, is sitting down with those suffering from addiction on who they are, where they come from, how did they get where they are, what's their goals moving forward. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. How do we treat pain in the emergency department? We still need to treat pain, but as opposed to the late 90s, early 2000s, where we had this mantra that everybody deserved to be pain-free, everybody in here realizes, especially if you skied today, that you're not always pain-free. And if you're not in pain right now, you're going to wake up tomorrow and realize that you skied today. Addiction prevention. How do we scan and screen for these folks? How do we make sure that we decrease that risk when we're giving a pain medicine to a person? What about how do we look and educate people into alternatives to opioids? Purdue Pharma targeted rural primary care physicians because they didn't have pain management experience and training, because they could drive the narrative. In fact, they actually targeted the top 10% of prescribers. They left the other 90% alone because they were not financially feasible to the company. So I'd never had a call from Purdue Pharma to come talk about their new fancy medication in the 90s and early 2000s. That's because they were targeting a very specific audience. Public education, we're seeing a big shift. Not as much, that whole sweep it under, junkies they should die, they're supposed to die, we'll be better without them kind of approach to things. Mainly because it's impacting every home, every family, every business, everybody that's out there. And everybody now has somebody that they've had, they're like, oh, I thought that they were put together. And then they have this. This must be significant. Our patients and then policymakers, of course. We're working on a lot of legislation in Kentucky right now because the hospital association is trying to wreck the EMS system. And we're finding out that a lot of the policymakers actually don't even know what EMS is. Really don't know how emergency medicine works into it. And I think all of us can understand and feel that a lot of times our C-suite doesn't really understand really what happens in the emergency department, much less what happens to get that patient to you to begin with. Evolve practice. We need to have those alternative to opioids. We need to continue to treat people based on their needs and their presentation, that patient in front of you. So you now have two talks in a row that say, treat the patient that's in front of you. All right, so next, whoever's speaking next, that's your challenge. You got to work that in. All right, we got to treat who's in front of you. Access to recovery. This is key. People have to be able to get recovery at the time that they need it. The key to recovery in any type of use disorder is not putting roadblocks or gaps in the bridge. It's about working them through the continuum and getting them from step to step to step. Every break we have in recovery is an opportunity for relapse and failure and overdose and death. So we want to have access to recovery. And of course, one of the things is the buprenorphine. Growing up in the Southeast, I was completely against it. Replacing any drug with a medication that was anywhere close to it. I was from Atlanta, Georgia, and then from East Tennessee up in the Tri-Cities area. I was all against that. First change was going to the needle exchanges. Like, okay, that makes sense. That's harm reduction. But then looking at the medications and looking at buprenorphine in the ED, if we initiate buprenorphine in the ED for recovery, 78% of those are still engaged in recovery at 30 days. If I just have an intervention, don't do that. And then referral, even a facilitated referral, that number is 45%. If I just give them a card for a referral, that number is 37%. So I could double our success by getting them engaged with that medicine. And it's not the point of making the emergency department into the landing site and a bridge clinic. It is the initiation and then bridging them to that clinic that will continue to follow them moving forward. And that's one of the things that's been a challenge to work on is how do we build those relationships that somebody has access to recovery 24/7, 365. We're one of the only professions that understands that medicine happens every second of every day. But unfortunately, our system is geared to the fact that we are only going to do things 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, excluding holidays. So it becomes very difficult if I'm going to say, hey, when you come in, I can't get you into anywhere for 3 days. It's about getting those resources arranged, allocated, and coordinated. We have to up our game, I mean, honestly. And we have to be the hope for these patients as we move forward. We have the tools. Many in here probably practiced before the era of the ultrasound, the ultrasound-guided nerve-related blocks. Every single one of our patients, our elderly patients who comes in that's not on a blood thinner, who's broken their hip, we either do the ultrasound-guided femoral nerve block, or anesthesiology comes down and does it for us. That way we can decrease that burden on a traditionally older, more frail population, decreasing those potential complications while making them more comfortable during their surgery and recovery. Other things of that nature in terms of nerve blocks and trigger point injections, over-the-counter medications. I mean, there's this thought that it's like the same. You mentioned the antibiotics. The assumption that if I can pick the antibiotics up with prescription, it's not as good as the antibiotic I get through an IV, that it has to be better because it comes with a needle. Same thing with the medications. If I can get it over-the-counter, it clearly can't be as good as what I have to have a prescription for. But some of the best medications we have at our disposal are right there on the shelves, ready to go right now. We just have to educate on the right doses, right times, right medications, looking at the risk factors and things that would change it. Looking at some more of that functional medicine, why not start to target why people have this pain and these symptoms? Find the problem and treat the problem. We've been masking it for 30 years now, 25, 30 years. So looking at things such as physical therapy, some of that mindfulness, some of that meditation, stretching, those types of things. And I know a lot of people don't like I'm going to go to PT. I'm going to hurt like crazy for the next few days. Yeah, but it's what's going to make you feel better long term. So looking at some of those things are really what we need to do. But unfortunately, now the insurers have to catch up as well. California Bridge is a wonderful group that I like to, that I've worked with on occasion, done a lot of their courses, introduced a lot of hospitals to their program. I don't do anything with them officially by any means or more version. But what it looks at is California Bridge, the feasibility and scalability. Basically, this is the idea that you don't reinvent the wheel. If somebody has figured out how to do this, let's take that information and plant that at our facility in our location. And working with them, folks like Dr. Alicia Kurtz-Gonzalez, who's been a friend of mine through ASAP for years, and is in California and really instrumental in this program, but looking at how to lower those barriers, connecting that care to the community, and a culture of harm reduction. And that's really what we're trying to accomplish during all of this time. What we've done in Kentucky is actually put together the largest overall opioid stewardship program in the country, including the emergency department, surgery, outpatient, and inpatients as well. What we did was we looked at how many pills does the average person, opioid, take after a gallbladder removal? Numbers between 4 and 8. The average prescription was 30. And so you've got 22 to 26 tabs that are still sitting there. Number one place for the initial initiation or use of an opioid is the family medicine cabinet, if it's not a prescription that we've actually written. So keeping those out of the potential harm and risk of family, of children, of whoever it may be, but also looking at how do we maximize. We can't just go for the easy button and say, hey, I did this procedure for you, or I did this, I don't want to see you again. So I'm going to give you this as a parting gift in hopes that we don't have to meet again until an arranged time down the road. So there has to be processes by which we are stewards of the opioids that need to be used, maximization of the pain management based on the presentation, and then pulling all of that together and monitoring it to where we can keep that patient on the straight and narrow. Portsmouth, Ohio is actually the place that's focused in the both the Dreamland and the Least of Us book. And initially, it was seen as the home or the epicenter as an example of the opioid epidemic in America. But now it's becoming the home and epicenter of recovery. There's folks, a large group of folks from West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, that are seeking to go to Portsmouth because it's a place where it's accepted, where they are accepted in recovery, that it's not perfect, they may fail, they may relapse, and we need to get them back on again. Places, jobs that are willing to hire people that have felony records because of the opioid epidemic, that have a recent record, that will work with them and understand that though it's a little bit hard, it is something that will invest in somebody's future to get them their family and life back. So Portsmouth, Ohio, a little town on the Ohio River, is a fantastic example of where things can go. And they admit that it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but at the same time, it is a step. And each person in that community, whether it's the person who's a long-term CrossFitter who found that fitness and exercise was a great recovery technique, opened up a CrossFit gym that catered towards those that had opioid use disorders, or companies that came in and opened up specifically looking to hire those in recovery. You know, all of these small little points and nuggets that the communities pull together, because we can't do it as physicians. We can change the way we treat people. We can manage pain by the most evidence-based methods, but I can't get them back into a job. I can't help them with their legal battles. I can't help them with transportation. It's very difficult once you've lost your license, for whatever reason it is, to get it back after you're recovering from opioids. And so taking out those speed bumps so the bridge can be continued to be traveled by these folks at every opportunity as they move down, taking out those roadblocks and potentials for failure. So go with the evidence. We can't become a victim of the easy button. It's so easy. When I was in residency, as soon as you came in, I've got pain. Boom, here's this medicine. Boom, here's a perk pack to go home. Hopefully I don't have to see you again. We didn't go to school and training as long as we did for this big part of our brain right here just to sit there idle because we hit the easy button. That is what being board certified in emergency medicine and being an emergency medicine specialist is about. It's about using your brain to take that person in front of you and building the care plan that they need to have the best outcomes possible. So don't paint every room the same color. We don't have a single solution. Some are going to go with abstinence. Some are going to go with medication for opioid use disorder assistance. Some may go with some sort of different combination. Use what that patient needs to get to the best results. The ALTO programs, we know that many therapies are consistently superior to opioids. If you look at back pain, you're going to see acetaminophen and ibuprofen show up once again. The best research is out there. It's not a muscle relaxer, it's not an opioid. Chronic pain, it does best with functional recovery as well as some of the over-the-counter medicines. Every game needs a champion. You gotta be a champion at your facility, at your hospital, your state. Educate, not only your group, but also those that are in your communities. Be a spokesperson for whatever local civic organizations are looking for information. They're starving for information to find out what they can do, the realities of what's going on in the next step. And honestly, I think one of the best tools we're going to have is those that have recovered from opioid use disorder. They have literally walked a mile in their shoes, maybe 2 miles, and they've come out the backside of it, and they can show that it can be done. So a combination in our emergency departments of social work, opioid or substance abuse management and navigators, as well as those that have been through it before. And then build broad and don't try to change the world, because it gets frustrating, it's challenging when you see 100,000 people are dying each year. You feel like you need to change the world, but maybe it just be the fact that you're going to change somebody's world. If I change somebody's world, then maybe that's going to ripple down. The next thing you know, you've got that whole butterfly effect, and people do, and then we're making a huge impact on the opioid crisis. So do your homework, know the evidence, be a champion, target low-hanging fruit. Some of the pain management things early are easy. We can probably knock out, from what we're seeing, you can cut opioid prescribing in your department and administration by 80 to 90% without significant impact on any type of patient satisfaction, turnaround times, and return. In fact, it's better. Better satisfaction, less likely to return to your department with ongoing pain or needing something for breakthrough pain, and more likely to be back at what they call a normal life afterwards. Educate, institutional change, expand and grow, and be that, spread the good word to those that are out there. So remember, if anybody says there's an easy button, in medicine, there's never an easy button. If not, we wouldn't have to go to as much school as we did. We wouldn't have to owe $400,000 to some institution to say, I'm qualified to do this. And unfortunately, hopefully, this is on its way out, at least in terms of a significant spike. But every time we've thought that we were done with it before, it's decided to throw us something different. But understand the difference as we move forward, how other factors, things that seem to be completely unrelated, may impact something such as the opioid progress or epidemic. So the cat's already out of the bag. It's hard to put cat back in the bag. So now we have to deal with what we have. We can't go back to 1996 and torpedo Purdue Pharmaceuticals. Would it have stopped it? Who knows? Somebody else may have done it. I mean, somebody would have figured it out. But now we've got to figure out how to do things moving forward. These are my favorite books. Chasing the Screams is really more about kind of the failure of the war on drugs. Dope Sick is about some recovery and some rural aspect. And then you have the two Sam Quinones books. If you haven't read those, they're great reads. And it's really enlightening to kind of see these different angles and viewpoints based on where you are in this continuum. All right, got a couple of minutes. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Great talk. Thank you. There's been some talk about getting rid of the X waiver.
Yep.
And just allowing everybody to prescribe. There's a lot of certainly wisdom to that. What is your thought on people getting X waivers, or at least maybe starting?
So the easy thing is the three-day rule, the rules regarding the three-day rule are basically done. We don't need to worry about three-day rule anymore. You know, they had to come in, you could dispense a medicine. They'd come in, you dispense it the second day, dispense it the third day. And that's all you could do without an X waiver. We did get right the transition with the last presidential election. It was going to be elimination of the X waiver. That got recanted. The X waiver is still there, but there has been changes that if you maintain less than 30 opioid use disorder patients, which in emergency medicine we technically have none, you only have to go online. You don't actually do the 8-hour course anymore. You go online to the DEA, you fill it out, you get your X waiver as long as you're under 30 patients. If you're over 30 patients, you have to do a separate course. ASEP's working on some education because the goal is we want people to have the information, but we don't want some merit badge, especially something called an X waiver, which sounds like it's dangerous. I mean, anything that starts with the word X seems like it's going to kick some ass like the X-Men. We need something of this, like recovery, whatever it may be. But if you haven't done it, it's easy. It's about a 5-minute process to go to DEA and get your X waiver, as long as you're under 30. If you're maintaining some sort of a bridge clinic where you're having patients long-term, you'll need a larger, the actual regular X waiver. But for most of us in emergency medicine, doing the 3-day initiation, doing a short course of induction to get them to a bridge clinic is all you really need to do, because we're not maintaining long-term patients. All right, thanks guys, appreciate it. Have a great week.